Only if you want to do
all right. We are going to call the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Division to order for Wednesday, April 8th. We have a very full agenda today. We will be needing to get together again this evening. We'll go as far as we can this morning. And we're going to just have to be really kind of fluid for the next few days, trying to get through a lot of bills. So members and other authors, try to work with us. We're not trying to be difficult. It's just we can't help it with the workload that is going to be coming our way in the next about a week. One change to the posted schedule is that we had been led to believe we would have to give up this room for an hour on Friday morning and not start until 9:30. Use is no longer needed, so we will start at 8:30 on Friday. We will notice that a little bit later today. But with that, how long are we going to go this morning? We'll go till 11 this morning, and then we will recess, and the plan is to reconvene at 6 o'clock this evening and finish with the agenda. So with that, any questions of members? Okay, Senator Wicklund, you're first up with Senate File 501. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I have Senate File 501. It's a bill about data on health disparities. You have before you Senate File 501 that deals with health disparities. I do have an amendment that includes technical and clarifying changes requested by different healthcare groups and state agencies to improve the bill and addresses questions and concerns. These amendments were adopted in the House Policy Committee, after which the bill was passed unanimously in that committee.
And Senator Wicklund, is the fiscal note drawn to accommodate the A7 amendment that's being passed out?
I believe it is drawn to that because it reflects the request from DHS for language to be included in our bill.
Oh, we have to fill in the blanks on the A7 on the second page.
Mr. Chair, I so move.
Well, let's find out what do we fill.
What do we fill in?
Yeah, what do we fill in?
Mr. Chair, they're members, on the
A7,
page 2, line 15, if you delete the second ... you know, that at the end there, not the first one, the second one, and insert $446,000. And on line 16, delete the ... and insert
$68,000. Okay.
So, Mr. Chair?
Senator Fischbach.
So, Mr. Chair, on line 212 and 215, there's still ...
No, those are deleting ... and replacing them with numbers in the bill.
Okay.
And so on 15 and 16, those are, it still didn't have them quite. So this would clean it up the way
Great.
I read it.
And then, Mr. Chair, before
Senator
we adopt
Fischbach.
The amendment, is are we going to get an explanation since it's...
We should, yes. Okay. It's not an author's amendment. It's not the first hearing. So, Senator Wicklund, now we have the amendment before us. Maybe you can describe the bill and explain the need for the amendment, and then we'll adopt it and take action on the bill.
Sure. So let me go back and just kind of go over the highlights of the bill first, and then I'll speak to the amendment. Senate File 501 improves the way healthcare data is used in Minnesota to measure and improve providers' quality of care. In particular, it improves the data for some subgroups of patients who experience health disparities and poorer health outcomes. Minnesota enjoys among the nation's highest rankings in overall health and quality of care, but we have among the nation's largest disparities for our racial and ethnic communities. This bill takes three steps to help reduce health disparities. First, it organizes the data so it can be broken down into additional categories of patient populations, making health disparities more visible. Second, it adjusts provider quality measures so providers are not harmed because of who they serve rather than their own clinical quality. And third, it requests that DHS make recommendations on improvements to provider payment rates to address the greater disparities for some patients. You have handouts and letters of support in your packets that show how important this bill is to providers and patients. One of the handouts is a letter from Dr. Ogawa, who practices at the Westside Community Health Center. Dr. Ogawa regrets that she was not able to be here this morning, but she provided a letter in which she states that according to current statewide quality measures, she is a good doctor when working in a mainstream clinic and a bad doctor when working in a community clinic serving low-income and diverse patients. Her professional knowledge and skill does not change, but the social and economic factors of the patients she serves affect her quality scores, putting her at risk of being penalized in quality reports and payment incentives because she chooses to serve patients with complex economic, social, and cultural barriers. Just as a note, we received the fiscal note last night and have not had a chance to fully analyze it yet. We're definitely willing to work with the chair and members of the committee to make amendments that may be needed to reduce the cost of the bill as needed to fit within the committee's targets and priorities for the omnibus bill. Overall, however, we believe it's vital to include this important work in our budget priorities as the omnibus bill is assembled to take additional steps to reduce health disparities. And just in terms of the amendment, the first few lines up to 1.6, we wanted to change. We had been including more specifics on on page 2, we had been including a list of factors that the commissioner might consider later, and it became evident that that wasn't the focus of the bill to include all these specific factors. It was to allow for the ability to work on those factors over time and to address whether, you know, which ones would be appropriate for which cases. And so we've changed the language to make it cleaner, just more streamlined, and still allows for more openness later on to add additional factors. So that's the first few lines of the amendment. From line 1.7 on, that's the language requested by DHS regarding the payment enhancement development process. And that's the, I guess that's the remaining part of the amendment, except for the, you know, the changes to add the appropriation amounts in it.
Okay. And you have a couple of testifiers?
Yes. First, I have Michael Scandrett.
Mr. Scandrett, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Michael Scandrett, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Healthcare Safety Net Coalition, which is a group of healthcare providers in Minnesota who are a nonprofit and whose primary mission is serving low-income and diverse patients. And so we're very happy to be here and happy that the bill is in front of the committee. We're very supportive of this. We're not going to spend a lot of time because we heard the chair's admonition to try to move quickly on this. So, again, you know, in the amendments that you have put, have attempted to address the remaining issues that we understand. And, again, it passed unanimously in the House with those amendments. We're trying to keep that going forward here. Just kind of the three things again is one, make sure that we can, that the disparities for particular racial and ethnic communities are visible in the data. And you have a handout from us that kind of illustrates one example of that, where you have, for example, we use the category of Asian communities in our data system. And so statewide average for optimal diabetes care for people from the Asian community is 44%. But if you look below that and you see that people who have immigrated from Thailand are generally receiving about 26% are getting optimal care, and if those from Vietnam are getting 57%. So that 44% does not tell you if you're working with communities from Vietnam or Thailand. You want to know how they're doing, and the communities themselves want that data so that they can work on it. So that's kind of that first part of it. The second that Senator Wicklund referred to is that many of the Safety Net Coalition members and providers are being kind of penalized right now because the quality is not, our methods of measuring quality are not precise enough to distinguish between the quality of care of the clinic and the characteristics of the patients served. And so just because you're serving patients that have a lot of barriers and issues, it makes you look like a poor provider, and then because your quality scores are lower, you're affected in your payment as well. So we want to address that. And the third piece, again, is asking that DHS develop, maybe there's a better way to address the actual payments made so that payments can reflect what it actually takes a clinic to provide the additional services and take them more time to work with patients who have additional barriers. So that's all we really need to say. We're available if we have any further questions, and I'll go on with the rest of the witnesses.
And this is Dr. Durwetti?
No. Monica Hurtado.
Monica Hurtado.
Oh, okay. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Monica Hurtado, and I'm the health equity organizer for Voices for Racial Justice. I'm here today also on behalf of ARCHE, the Alliance for Racial and Cultural Health Equity, to let you know that members of the different communities in Minnesota have been working towards this goal for many years. We are not only in support to collect data about race, ethnicity, language, and other sociodemographics, but we expect that data to be available to our communities so that we can use it to achieve health equity. Data on social determinants is critical to know what changes need to be made, and these changes need to be discussed and implemented in partnership with the communities impacted by those disparities. So this issue of data for health equity is part of the racial equity. We develop this agenda for racial equity every year, and this issue is part of the data. This data, this agenda is endorsed this year by more than 70 organizations across the state. And in the agenda, you can read the piece about this issue that says, count what matters. Collection of community-specific data that measure health disparity is key to develop solutions. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there another testifier? Okay. Oh, there's two more? We're trying to limit to two testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee members,
welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Roli Dwivedi. I'm a medical director at Community University Healthcare Center. We are located at Phillips Neighborhood Clinic, and we currently serve almost 12,000 patients annually, which come from 12 different racial and ethnic community. And also, more than 80% of our patient population is below the poverty line. I am here to request your support of SF501, as we need equity in provider quality scores in the statewide quality reporting. I'll share a brief story because I think we are lacking some time here. So I've been seeing a four-year-old African-American child who was brought to my clinic by her teenage mom in 2010 when she was 22 days old, and she was discharged from the hospital after being admitted into the neonatal intensive care unit with recurrent seizures. Teen mom didn't know what to do with the baby because she was teen and it was unintended pregnancy. Teen mom dropped out from the school. She didn't have a job. She didn't have a housing. Her main source of the support is the grandma, who also does not have a housing and also struggling with depression, anxiety, and the polysubstance abuse. Father of the baby is in and out of the jail, and this poor baby, who is only 22 day old, kept on having the seizures and ends up into the hospital. So, of course, I'm not going to meet the quality because there is so much going on. So we have what we did at Coop. We created a genogram of the family because all these qualities are related with one family member is attached to the other's family members. So we started taking slow steps by family, member by member. We gave them the access, we gave them the security, we gave them the safety. And all these 4 years have been very long, but we have been able to give them a little bit of quality of life. So, of course, I'm not going to meet the quality indicators, but mom is seeking the mental health care. She is sober now. Teenage mom has got the housing. And the kid else has got the immunization done. So I cannot meet the quality indicators what other people will be meeting. So I request your support for the SF501 because we cannot put all the providers in the same pot. We have to make sure that we are looking at the communities which we are serving, and these communities are in the need of the services. So I request your support. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. That's a very compelling example of what we're talking about here. And just to clarify, we've been asking authors to try to limit their testimony to 10 minutes and bring two, but we will be opening it up for public testimony if there are individuals from the public who wish to testify either in support or opposition. But we're just asking authors to try to be efficient with the committee's time. So that's just a – did you have other testifiers, Senator Whitman?
Justin Bell was going to testify for the American Heart Association. I think we can – defer that and open it to questions if you have questions that you would like to ask him.
So Senator Fischbach had moved the A7 amendment on that amendment. Is there questions?
On
the bill.
I didn't have questions, but Senator Rosen moved.
Yes.
I moved the bill.
Yep, we're going to question. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. actually, the question is for Mr. Scandrett, please.
I believe there he is. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Scandrett, you mentioned that the ethnic groups, different groups will be gathering information. How is that going to be gathered, and where is the coordination with the department and the accountability of that, the dollars spent in this program? How is that going to be measured?
Mr. Scandrett?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, I think what was intended was that this actually is going to use the current system of collecting data on quality and reporting quality measures. But what this will do then is break down that data into additional categories of racial and ethnic groups. And then what that would happen then is make that data that's coming through the state system available to the communities so they can see what's happening within their communities. So it's really just about how the existing data is divided up and then making sure that those communities themselves can see their own experience from the data and be able to work with their own communities to address the disparities. And this is all totally aggregated data. This is not individual data. It's data that's already being collected. It's just being would be divided into different categories.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. And that's through the statewide quality measurement program, of course. How are the different communities going to get that information? Are they privy to that information already? Are they will there be meetings set up with the department to go through that? And is that what's part of this fiscal note?
Mr. Chair and Senator
Mr.
Rosen.
Scandra.
Yes, because this is just going to be implemented, the fiscal note and the kind of general direction in the bill would set up the process for answering those questions. So we don't have the answers yet as to exactly what format some of that information would be provided to the communities in. And the bill does require that the department, though, work closely with those communities to figure out kind of what kind of data would be provided and how it would be organized so that it is useful. So that would yet – the details are yet to be determined, but the bill sets that process in motion.
Any other questions? Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I really don't have a question. I just wanted to mention to Senator Wicklund that later today, probably late this evening, there is a bill that I'll be introducing that is a diabetes prevention and education grant appropriation that's directed specifically toward trying to reduce these disparities. So I appreciate this bill in conjunction with that initiative.
Any other questions of members? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're just going through the fiscal note.
like a little bit better understanding. It looks like we're purchasing some data, new expenditure, and we're hiring people to analyze the data we're purchasing. I'm just trying to get it at what the cost drivers are.
Where on the fiscal note are you, Senator?
I'm just looking through it in general. I just would like to understand what we're getting for $1.8 million.
Yep. Mr. Scandrett, Senator Wicklund, Mr. Scandrett.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, we just saw the fiscal note this morning, and we did get alerted by the department. They were scrambling to get it to us in time. We know that we're going to have to work with the chair and the committees on how much money is available for this and look at the fiscal note much more closely. I don't think it will be anywhere near the dollar amounts that are in there, and then we'll have to further refine it again to be sure what is done. The reference to the purchasing of the data is the current relationship is the Minnesota Department of Health contracts with Minnesota Community Measurement, which is a community nonprofit. And so under that contract, if they want to get additional data from them, they need to pay them for that additional data. So the point is just we're asking for more breakouts of data, and that requires money for the department to be able to pay for that.
Well, I appreciate the recognition that we're going to have to work on this number. I just got this as well. This is something that I'm very interested in. If we can't measure the disparities, we're not going to succeed in the healthcare reforms and the new payment models. The system doesn't work if we can't recognize the differences of a population served. Any other questions, Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, I'm just concerned about the spend here. Well, there are a lot of things I'm concerned about, but we're getting reports on disparities from the Department of Health all the time. I'm not sure why we're hiring more people when we are continually being told without legislative requests, because every time we make a request, they want us to appropriate money. And then if they just want to do a one-off report, they find the resources. And this is part of their job already as they've defined it themselves. And so I could understand paying an outside vendor for more granular data. The rest of it, I'm going to have a big problem with. They don't need more people to do something that they're already doing.
Okay. Any other questions of members? Seeing none. Senator Fischbach, did you move the A7 amendment, or was I wrong?
I moved it. Yes.
Senator Rosen moves the A7 amendment. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. So now the bill is in shape. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 501? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and offer your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And we have long been concerned about the collection of data on patients without their consent or knowledge, a pressure within the healthcare system to offer data about themselves that can be used for purposes that they don't wish. So when we look at this, and this is the budget committee after all, we just look at how the entire process will increase the cost of health care, increasing not only at the state level, but likely as well at the clinic, hospital level, for all the additional information that has to be added to the systems. They have to have the time, paperwork, whatever it requires, change to ask all of these potential questions that the Commissioner of Health could decide that every clinic and every hospital has to ask every patient. So we look at the cost of the system, the cost, the additional cost to healthcare, the cost of the technology, and potentially the cost of litigation. When I listened to the testimony, I heard two things. One, that you don't want to penalize doctors through the payment system. Clearly, the payment system of measuring quality hasn't worked. I don't know that the payment system of measuring equity and health equity with disparities with all of this data is going to work either. As one of the testifiers said, it's not precise enough. Well, it's never going to be precise enough until you get down to the DNA, and maybe it won't be precise enough then, because a lot of what happens with a patient is because of the patient, because of the beliefs, the physiology, the side effects, the DNA, whatever, of the patient. And you're not going to be able to get that kind of information to determine why that is a part of the outcomes that have happened with patients. So, and on the way there, you get to where the healthcare system becomes a place where patients have to protect themselves against being profiled by having all of their data taken in order for their doctors to get paid. So this is a cost in many ways, but I do believe at the financial level, it's certainly a cost for the department, as we see from the fiscal note, and it's certainly going to be a cost for the clinics and the hospitals who have to change their systems and have to spend the time trying to convince people why they have to give this kind of information about themselves. And clearly, if you pass this bill, you will still have no idea what the commissioner will decide that every patient has to answer in order for their doctor to be paid fully. So that all of that is a concern to us. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony in support or opposition to Senate File 501? Seeing none, any additional questions from members? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 501 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee members.
Next, we have Senator Champion with Senate File 452.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Welcome.
For the opportunity to speak briefly about Senate File 452, and just as a potential roadmap, Mr. Chair, I am going to have two amendments, and the second amendment will amend the first amendment, but I just want to kind of give you that roadmap if that's possible. But Senate File 452 is a bipartisan jobs and health.
We have one amendment with us. Do you want us to pass out the second amendment as well, just so that we can be looking at it?
Yes, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
We'll get that. All right, go ahead.
So, again, Mr. Chair, Senate File 452 is a bipartisan jobs and health innovation grant program based on the successful multi-year effort to develop best practices for assisting individuals that are leaving our correctional facilities. The original legislation started this endeavor, passed in 2007 with the support of now Hennepin County Commissioner Linda Higgins. This bill is to create a fund that can be used by DHS to support better futures as it continues to develop best practices and serves as a model, and to build additional sites using these best practices at other locations in the state of Minnesota. The first being the Northwest Indian OIC, which is in Bemidji. It has a high incarceration population, high native population, low employment, high chemical and addiction as well, amongst other things. What we know about individuals that leave state prison or the county correction system is that they are more likely homeless, jobless, without post-secondary education or even high school diplomas. Often they suffer from mental illness and trauma-induced stress, poor physical health, disengaged with family, including their own children. So they have a number of issues. If we don't find and use methods that work, we know that they are likely to circle back into the correctional facilities, and we all know that that is a very costly idea. So this model is one that is addressing a larger public health concern amongst this population through housing concerns, sober living, case management, and reducing their return to prison. And the legislation proposes to create a fund to not only support the continuation of this model, but to expand it to other communities in the state. So, Mr. Chair, I have a few testifiers, and I know that they will be brief, who provide details about this proposal in greater detail. And so if we could start with wonderful person that is running this great program, that would be great.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Thomas Adams. I am the president and CEO of Better Futures Minnesota. With me, I have Kevin Hardwick, our director of integrated care, and a participant, should any questions about some program specifics be desired of them. I want to thank the committee for giving me the opportunity to speak about Senate File 452 today. I thank Senator Chairman. I want to thank the Department of Human Services for their current funding of our model. As Senator Champion stated, in 2007, Better Futures committed to working with men who had high incidences of childhood trauma, high morbidity rates, poor health indicators. These men were absentee fathers and high users of acute care services. These men had addiction challenges and mental health illnesses and were chronically homeless, unemployed, and repeat offenders. We set about through funding from the state to identify best practices to stabilize this population and put them on a path towards self-sufficiency. And 8 years later, we've identified a model that is an integrated service delivery model that provides life skill coaching, worker readiness training and employment, cognitive behavioral therapy, health and wellness services, parent engagement, and housing. And in your packet, there's a diagram that focuses on all of the services that we provided. We've had challenges along the way. We constantly seek to get better. In 2007, we knew that we didn't know everything that it would take to stabilize this population, but that the status quo was unacceptable. And so as a result, we committed ourselves to extensive external evaluations, and we used the results of those evaluations to strengthen our model. So we can confidently say that we are stronger today than we've ever been before. Our model has multiple benefits. This is not uncommon in an integrated model that we provide. So the lowered recidivism is a benefit of our model. Increased employment and skill attainment is a benefit of our model. But just as important is increased parent engagement, increased connection to health homes, increased positive health indicators, and decreased homelessness are all positive outcomes associated with our model. So our model is anchored in research and best practices that understand that mental health challenges, addiction, and healing the trauma that these men have endured are critical to stabilization and self-sufficiency. So we know it works. We have a best practice model. Our model is comprehensive and has multiple benefits, and our calculations show a great return on investment. So we're thankful for our current support for the Department of Human Services. We ask that this committee support Senate File 452 to help sustain and introduce this model into other communities throughout the state of Minnesota, in particular the greater Bemidji area, because we know that the adult male Native population in that community is experiencing similar negative outcomes across an array of social, health, and educational benefits. And so with that, I'll turn it over to my partner in Bemidji.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Talia Palmer. Good morning, Chairman and committee members. My name is Talia Palmer. I'm the Executive Director for Northwest Indian OIC. We're located in Bemidji, Minnesota, and we serve Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, the Red Lake Nation, and the White Earth Nation. The 60-mile radius of Bemidji, as you know, has a high disparity rate. We serve approximately 7 counties in that area that represent the highest disparities of health equity in the state of Minnesota. And for the sake of time and everyone's attention, I just want to say that we're a relatively new reintegration program. And the reason that we're a reintegration program is historically we've been a jobs program. And what we've seen with this particular population is that the needs of this population are so complex and interwoven into health and human services that we had to expand this programming and to operate in a more integrated manner. And so partnering with Better Futures Minnesota has been a really unique opportunity for us. And we've been able to better serve the clientele that we're targeting. And specifically looking at the mental health needs, the traumatic brain injury disparities of the American Indian population, 6 out of 10 men released from prison that are American Indian have traumatic brain injury. The housing shortages in Bemidji show 1% vacancy rate, and of the available housing in Bemidji, only 3 landlords are willing to rent to felony records. Most of the men that we're working with have been in and out of the system since they were juveniles, and so it's a very complex situation. Another unique aspect of what we're doing is working with responsible fatherhood and helping men rebuild relationships with children that they've fathered. Oftentimes, these men have experienced not just historical trauma in the American Indian population, but constant and consistent trauma in their life. And so learning basic relationship skills, life skills, providing us opportunities to expand the life skill services that we operate through the Adult Rehabilitative Mental Health Services with the Department of Human Services has been extraordinarily helpful. We believe that we're ready in terms of capacity to expand this program. And to give you an idea of the demand on our program is that we have actually had to limit who we're able to serve, wherein you can only have services if you've been released within the past 90 days. And otherwise, we're having to turn people away. The level of men who are coming home and the impact on their families, their primary families, and then their extended families, is extraordinary. And this program serves a really unique need in our region. And I can also say, coming from a rural community, that these are my neighbors. That this is something that I feel very personally. Convicted of that, this is a very significant community health issue that we really need to tackle, in particular in rural communities where I'm most familiar with. And that being said, I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Mr. Adams, you mentioned a couple of times the current DHS funding for this. What were you referencing?
We currently receive funding from. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we currently receive funding from the Department of Human Services for this model for the five outcomes that this model focuses on, which is housing, lower recidivism, connection to a health home, parent engagement, and increased employment.
Okay. And what is how much is that current?
That is 200,000, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's 200,000.
Okay. And it's part of the makeup of your service package.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, it is. It's part of the overall financial revenue that supports Better Futures.
Okay. That's helpful. Any questions? Senator Sharon.
And would he mind describing other sources of revenue for the project?
Mr. Adams, yeah, do you have sort of a where do you get the balance of your revenue to run yours?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We receive funding from the county, Hennepin County. We receive funding from about $1 million from Hennepin County over three different initiatives. We have some business initiatives. We're a social enterprise, so we have some business initiatives with them. They support service funding from us. We do receive money from the Department of Human Services. About $1 million or 800 or so is from earned revenue through our lines of business. About another $1 million is private philanthropical funds that we raise, and then we have service contracts with the municipalities in the state of Minnesota I just mentioned.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Champion. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. Mr. Adams, can you expound a little bit on those lines of business, i.e. the independent line of business you have and then the contracts you have with the county that are for services rendered? Can you tell us a little bit more? I think the committee would like to hear about that.
Mr. Adams.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have currently four lines of business. We have a janitorial line of business. We have a property maintenance line of business. We have an appliance recycling line of business, and we have a deconstruction line of business. And those lines of businesses we chose were all easy entry, low-skilled lines that we could put our men into work immediately. This was done because of a practical reason that our men needed employment, and there were not a lot of employers out there who were hiring men of our background. So we, our largest vendors are municipalities because of the latitude that they give with working with men of our background. And then we also have service contracts. And so a service contract with Hennepin County provides funds for us to increase employment, to reduce recidivism and to stabilize our men. So those are three outcomes that they purchased. Our contract with Department of Human Services covers five previous outcomes that we talked about. And so there are service outcomes that provide stabilization with the chart that I mentioned before, these five areas of life skill coaching, employment services, housing, parent engagement, health and wellness. And so service funding pays for these types of services, these comprehensive, integrative, core kind of mental health social support services. And then our contracts, our business revenue, support our lines of business.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. And in the A3 amendment, there's reference to $3 million being appropriated to a nonprofit which is currently providing services for rural Minnesota. Is that organization also receiving resources or partnering with other community resources at this time?
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon. For clarity, I wish we only had one amendment, because by having two, I knew it would cause a little confusion.
Yep.
So the A3 amendment that you so eloquently referenced, the lines 1.9 through 1.14 will be replaced, if the committee so allows, with the A4 amendment, which really gets to identifying the opportunities for OICs and then also this organization. So there was an attempt in the A3 to identify different organizations, which I think it fell short, which is why this morning we had to make that change. I hope that explains it, but I could continue to talk about it if you need for me to do so, Senator Sharon. But the A4 will replace that language that you see on the A3 amendment, from lines 1.9 to 1.14 will be replaced.
Thank you, and Senator
Sharon.
Yeah, what I think that it would be helpful, whether it's your organization, Mr. Adams, or another organization that's not specifically identified here. I assume it's in Bemidji, based on what I heard.
I think there's two organizations here, basically, and that after we're done with the A4, that $3 million of the $4 million would go to these two organizations, basically, the way I read the A4. So if we do adopt the A3 and the A4 in combination, we're getting rid of the preference that was given to session law from 2007. We're getting rid of the language that said up to three organizations would get an award, and the requirement of a match. Why, I guess another question would be, why are we getting rid of the requirement for a match?
Mr. Chair, it is my understanding that one of the reasons for getting rid of the match is because we want to make sure that other organizations that may not be as greatly resourced will have an opportunity to compete for these opportunities as well. And so that's my understanding, unless someone else, Nancy or others, want to come and speak directly to that. But that's my understanding for the reason to get rid of the match.
So would these two organizations still be expected to? They're not required to if we adopt these amendments, but are they expecting to still meet this match? It would be for the balance of the $1 million above the $1 million above the $3 million that's in the appropriation, so those would allow for smaller organizations that may not have the resources to match. Is that what I heard you say? But, I mean, the match requirement is lifted for the entire $4 million, is the way I read this.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that the match requirement would be lifted, so that any organization who is seeking to compete for these grants, namely would also be the Northwest OIC as well as Better Futures, but it could have the potential for others as well if there's someone else who would come forward and demonstrate an initiative that would be accepted, there would be no match requirement. Again, there's a belief that some people have the thought that different people should have skin in the game, and so if there's some other match, and therefore we can have greater opportunity. That is one argument, one viewpoint. But the other viewpoint is that we want to make sure that if there's someone who may not be as well resourced but have the model and have the ability to deliver the services articulated in this proposal, that they should be considered as well, notwithstanding if they have a match. So that's my understanding, unless Mr. Adam want to expound upon that.
And Senator Benson had a question on this point in particular. It might help.
Yeah.
Senator Benson.
Just, it looks to me like the match completely goes away. So this was part of the policy that we passed. What motivated the elimination of up to three organizations per biennium? Sounds like we're doing carve-outs for two organizations instead of the competitive grant that we talked about in policy. So there's no match at all. It's not lifted. It's eliminated. And why aren't we being competitive? We're doing carve-outs.
Mr. Adam.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can address the first part of your question, Senator Benson, in terms of the match. We can meet the match for the collaborative. Better Futures can. That's a function that we can provide. The match of $1.5 million.
There's $3 million that would go to these two organizations in the A3 and A4 combination, but that's not 1.5 for Better Futures and 1.5 for Northwest OIC. I mean, it could be 2.9 for Better Futures and 100,000. It could be 2.9 for Northwest OIC. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't really say that. But anyway, Senator Rosen also had.
Well, Mr. Chair, on that, the A3 specifically said the $3 million, but the A4 just to support a collaborative.
The A4 actually keeps the $3 million. The A4 deletes line 1.10 to 1.14, so it keeps the $3 million appropriated to it. Takes over at the beginning of line 1.10.
Mr. Chair, we haven't adopted the A3, though.
We haven't adopted either. Yeah. We're just kind of having a
discussion.
I said we were going to be fluid. we have the A3 and the A4. You know, Senator Champion alerted the committee that he was going to be trying to get our cooperation in adopting these two. And so,
And if I might, Mr. Chair?
Senator Champion.
A notion I want the committee to also be mindful of, the A3 and A4 is really a representation of commitments that I provided even at the last stop, which was with Senator Nelson, that we would make sure that some of her concerns were addressed, and this is our attempt to address her concerns from the last stop that we had here as well. So I wanted the committee to be clear about that as well. And again, I wish that it would have been one amendment, but because there were some things that occurred prior to me seeing it, that's how we ended up with the A3 amendment, and then I had to talk to the powers that be, and not staff. It's not staff's challenge. It was a challenge on our end, and then we had to make sure that we had it correct and done correctly, and that's why we are also putting forward the A4 amendment, which amends the A3 amendment. So
Senator
perhaps
Sharon.
If we get some action on the amendments, that would help focus our discussion.
Somebody wish to move the A3?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move.
Senator Hayden moves the A3 amendment, and then procedurally, I guess, also moves the A4 amendment to the A3 amendment so that it's before us and we can continue the conversation. Senator Fischbach?
Mr. Chair, I was wondering, I guess, and I'm looking. I guess it's the A3 that deletes some language on page 2. I was just looking up that language, and I guess it's not the matching language, and I'm wondering if there's an explanation, because it's the demonstration project for high-risk adults, and it's talking about some of the things that should be required, and I'm wondering why that language is being eliminated. It looks like you're in the A3 amendment taking out line 212 to 214. And I'm just, if you could just explain that reason.
Absolutely.
It's not the
Senator Champion?
Mr. Chair, thank you. That was one of the concerns when we were at the last stop, is that is that the body did not want those who could be eligible for this grant or these grants to only be those restricted to their appearance in the 2007 chapter. And so the only individuals mentioned in that era of law would be Better Futures. They were the demonstration project.
So, in essence, the reference to this session law, which isn't even in the statute books, it's kind of hard to find, actually, was a specific reference that described Network for a Better Futures, and there was some discomfort with this, you know, reference to old session law that I think is trying to address those concerns.
Yes.
So, Mr. Chair, the way I understand that this is just too
Senator
narrowly
Fishbaugh.
Written. This is too narrowly written. And okay.
Yes.
But I just wanted to make sure I understood why we were eliminating it. Thank you.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, to Senator Fishbach's point, I understand the reference to session law, but I don't know what objectives we're deleting because I see the drafting of the fiscal note. So maybe, Senator Champion, you could help us with what some of those objectives are that we're deleting?
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, can you repeat, Senator, your
Senator
question?
Benson.
Because your voice was up and then it went low, and I'm having a hard time hearing in this room, period.
My apologies, Senator Champion and Mr. Chair. As we're deleting that reference to session law, the organizations had to demonstrate the ability to meet the objectives set forth in that session law. What were those objectives, and are they referenced somewhere else so that we know what we're holding people accountable for?
Now, thank you so much. So,
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair and Senator, it's referenced in the body of it because the aim and aspiration is to deal with this high touch population. And so when we think in terms of individuals coming out of prison, those with mental health issues, those with homeless issues, that's the network, that's this work, and so it's embodied in their work already.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Benson.
Senator Champion, you said it's embodied. Where is it embodied? I don't see it in here. Can you help me find it?
If you go to Senator 2.18, you will see some of the things there. We're employed full-time or part-time. They're talking about organizations receiving a grant under this section must report annually to the commissioner on the numbers of program participants who, number one, were employed full-time or part-time. We know that's the employment issue. Made child support payments, if applicable. That was very important because a part of the demonstration is that they not only wanted these individuals to be working, but they wanted them also to relieve, for lack of better words, some of the social program issues that we have, which is around child support. 2.20, avoided institutionalization or incarceration. That gets to returning back to prison because the whole idea is that we want them to be out, productive, and so forth. And so therein lies the articulation of some of the criteria that was necessary for the demonstration project that was outlined in 2007, Chapter 54, Article 1, Section 19.
And the A3, you added two to that list of criteria as well, located in the non-metro area and were women and minorities. So there's two additional criteria added by the A3 to the ones that you mentioned. But Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, it looked like Senator Sharon was raising her hand. I don't want to step in front. So to the A3 amendment, why in the report are we just calling out people who were in the non-metro area? Why aren't we referencing geographic distribution? And why are we adding a line of women and minorities when we could just have demographic information called out? This feels awkward. I don't know why we're carving out non-metro when we don't have a requirement for metro. Can you help me, Senator Champion?
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator. We did that at the request of Senator Nelson. That is what Senator Nelson asked for. That's why we focus that information, and that's why I mentioned earlier that the A3 and the A4 amendments were a reflection of those earlier concerns and conversations that I made the commitment that we would seek to address before appearing before this wonderful body.
Senator Hayden.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, and thank you once again, Senator Champion, I think this kind of happens in our process where we make commitments from one committee to another, and then the next committee may have the issues. I think what, if we remember, and I just happened to be there, that Senator Champion made a commitment through a line of questioning, not only from Senator Nelson, but other legislators that represented Greater Minnesota about expanding this and ensuring that their communities would have an opportunity to participate if they so wished in this wonderful project. So I think what we're dealing with here and why it maybe feels a little awkward, Senator Benson, is if this is a kind of a body of work that is growing, and so we're not always involved in each of the stops. But what I see is this is a reflection, and if we want to change the language to make people feel more comfortable, so be it. But I think what you're seeing in Senator Champion's bill is him meeting his commitments to members of the body that had concerns that this may not be able to reach their communities because they were supportive of it, but wanted to ensure that if there were organizations in their part of the state that wanted to participate or that were doing work like this, that they could get an opportunity to do so. So if indeed we want to go down this road of trying to make the next legislator feel a little more comfortable, I think we could continue to do that, Mr. Chair, but I think that there's an opportunity and a true reflection from Senator Champion and the folks in front of us to make sure that they're as inclusive as they possibly could to ensure that a program that I think is worthy of our consideration, that is really working hard to take ex-offenders or to bring folks that are coming out of prison and allow them to get on with their lives, that we have this in the greatest possible reach. I guess the greatest reach possible is what I'm trying to say, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just respond.
Senator Champion.
Everything that Senator Hayden said is spot on. And Senator Benson, earlier you asked me about, you know, the language that I regurgitated from 2.18 on about the reporting requirements and how do we be assured that the criteria that the 2007 session law was embodied here. I also just want to turn your attention to the selection of grant recipients, which starts at 1.21 and goes all the way until 2.11. I just want you to see that that was there as well. So thank you.
Senator Benson,
Mr. Chair,
I think that we're getting a pretty good understanding of what the amendments do. We can ask a few more questions, but we're going to have to actually take a vote on them before too long. Senator Benson.
Not trying to drag this out.
No, it's on.
I'm just looking at how awkward this report is going to be. I understand he's trying to meet Senator Nelson's request, but by asking, you know, for women and minorities, this is just going to be a really awkward report. And so we can move on, and if the amendment gets adopted, I can work on more eloquent language. But right now, I have been sitting here trying to figure out how to just turn it to we're located in but because we use program participants who, I'd like geographic distribution and demographic distribution. It's much more general. It gives the department the ability to be flexible in what they do and actually get us good information. But I'm moving on because I can't figure out how to make this graceful in its reporting request. And so that was my only concern with that piece.
Senator Sharon, you had been
I think that if you want to move the amendments, then I'll reserve my question for
on Senator
that.
Hayden's motion to move the A3 amendment as amended by the A4 amendment. Any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Okay, so now we got the bill in shape. Senator Sharon.
Then the other thing that Senator Champion or committee members said, since we've eliminated the match, I just wonder if, first of all, I'm thinking of this initially when I was hearing about it as initiative funds, and because the match was there. But when I look at the note itself, it looks like this is an ongoing. As a matter of fact, the language of the bill says on page on the lines 3.5 that the appropriation
does not cancel and is available until expended, and it says this appropriation is ongoing. So that means that the money, if not expended, can accumulate, and then it sounds like there's more money coming in whether it's expended or not, according to how this is articulated. And it is sort of doing base funding for the organization, at least it sounds like that, and on an ongoing basis. And so that's my one comment. I'm not sure we really want to do that. And or I don't even know if that's what the author intends here. But and then the other thing in terms of the match is gone, that we should maybe consider some sustainability requests, that maybe in the first year the organization receives the grant, but in the reporting requirements that the plan for sustainability or ongoing funding be there, unless the intent is that we can that we underwrite on an ongoing basis this proposal. And that's, I guess I need some clarification about the intent about that.
The intent is to have this an ongoing appropriation, and were we to pick this up off the table, we have the language to fix up the appropriations, and we really don't do appropriations that don't cancel any longer, so we would have been striking does not cancel and inserting available until June 30th of 2019. That's just sort of what we do, and then we would also pay for the admin. We, rather than saying a percentage, we would say 97,016 and 83,017 may be used for administration of the grant program. So we would just, by matter of practice, clean up the appropriation sections. I don't think we need to make that amendment here. We could if we wanted, but that would be cleaned up were this to be picked up off the table. Other questions? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The fiscal note in the bill refer to creating new full-time or part-time positions, and we've heard from Better Futures. Could the Northwest OIC talk about the current program they have for creating jobs? Because it requires new jobs. And with $4 million a year, you can create a whole lot of jobs. But I'd like to know that they have something already in place.
Chairman and committee members, thank you for that question.
Ms. Palmer.
We have been partnering with Better Futures Minnesota for the past year to improve the job creation strategy that we have with reentry. What we had found when we started our reentry program was that we didn't have employers willing to hire felons in the Bemidji area. They are very excluded from the workforce. And so in partnering with Better Futures and the three tribes, we've been working on deconstruction and green jobs initiatives. Some of that has to do with taking apart other buildings and reproducing new products. Some of it has to do with salvaging materials. We're looking at the janitorial custodial business and looking at the social enterprise model of that. And so, for example, we recently completed a cohort of 40 men. American Indian men went through this program. They received 6 weeks of industry-recognized training. We partnered with Beltrami County to deconstruct a Masonic lodge. They had on-site training and employability. Half of those men were then placed into positions with partnered construction companies that were willing to take a risk and hire them after they had gone through our program. And so we have a multifaceted approach where we're doing some of the job creation and employability metrics ourselves, and some of it has to do with working directly with regional employers to build trust and relationships so that they understand what the training components are that we're doing and also the sort of social supports that we're providing to the men that we're working with.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 452? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves Senate File 452 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Champion, I think that we're moving a lot slower than we intended. I'm going to need to bump you. We have a bill that has two mothers who have been that who need to leave by 10, and we need to take Senator Franzen at this point.
Mr. Chair, I am happy to do whatever the committee wants, but I think I made a mistake this morning because someone said to me, how long do you think your bills are going to take? I said, no problem. These bills are not going to take long at all.
Senator Lurie?
It happened. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. And as Senator Franzen begins, I just thought I would want to say again that we, as you have said already, that you know we have a tight timetable here, and I think people get confused. What would be helpful to me, to those who are here to present their bill or to testify to a bill, that this is the Finance Committee, and although lots of times the testifiers are telling their stories about how this impacts them or why, we have done that in policy already, and I really need the time to talk about the finance component of these bills. So I'm hoping if you're here to testify on a bill that you're focusing on the finance issues. We want to understand the purpose of the bill, but then how does the finance help accomplish the bill and how to justify the finances? That would be very helpful to me, and I think it would get us properly focused.
Senator Franzen, Senate File 948, FAS Grants Appropriation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. So Senate File 948 expands the fetal alcohol spectrum prevention services to several communities across Minnesota. This bill is not new to this committee. We've appropriated funds before. It builds off a successful integrated care model from Olmsted and St. Louis counties. And we are pleased that Governor Dayton has actually included recommended funding for FAS prevention in his supplemental budget or his bill this year, $540,000 each year. Our bill actually asks for more, specifically $2 million each year, so that we can expand these services into more communities. And the problem, as you may be aware, is that each year there's an estimated 5,367 pregnant women in Minnesota expose their babies to alcohol and puts them at risk for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This bill would save taxpayer dollars that would otherwise go for expensive health and educational services to mitigate the effects of FASD. Children diagnosed with FASD incur Medicaid costs 9 times higher than a child without the FASD, $16,782 versus $1,859. This bill will use the funds to support effective local partnerships between local governments and community organizations, and with direct focus on helping at-risk mothers to stay clean during their pregnancy. This Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder will work with community partners on ensuring that most effective best practices are deployed across the state to prevent a truly 100% preventable disability. I do want to note briefly, in your packets you should have a letter from former First Lady of Minnesota, Susan Carlson, who was has been key in this issue, bringing this issue to the forefront. And one piece I want to highlight is research has shown that alcohol causes far greater harm to the brain than any other drug combined, which is sometimes we don't talk about that. And certainly this is being 100% preventable disease. It will save taxpayer dollars by making sure that kids are not exposed to it through the mother during pregnancy. With me today, I have two testifiers that have benefited from the CRAFT project in Olmsted County. Ms. Katie Siever is an alumni, and then Eileen Hendrickson is a client. So if your committee, Mr. Chair, will indulge both of them, they will introduce themselves and proceed with their testimony.
Ms. Siever, is that correct? Welcome to the committee.
Yep.
State your name for the record one more time.
Katie Siever.
And provide your testimony.
All right. Mr. Chair and members, I think this is so important for other mothers suffering from substance abuse who are pregnant, wanting to become pregnant, or have children. Before I came to testify last time I was here at the House, I knew how much this meant to me, but I didn't realize how important the program was or could be to others. The biggest impact for me was the mother who shared how she could have benefited and prevented her son from getting FAS rather than suffering and staying stuck in her addiction. And after a young woman came up to us and shared that she had FAS and wished her mom had the opportunity to have the resources and support to raise her sisters and her, who all had it. The program was so beneficial to me to gain the confidence to be the person I needed and wanted to be. I started lost and confused, pregnant and alone. Now I have found myself, my way, lifelong friends and resources. I am a happy, healthy, loving mother, an electrician apprentice, and going on 3 years of recovery from my addictions, thanks to the CRAFT program. And thank you for the time and opportunity to share.
Ms. Seaver, thank you for your story. And then I didn't write fast enough. I didn't catch your name.
Eileen Hendrickson.
Ms. Hendrickson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I started the program in 2003 when I was pregnant, and I was sober then. I stayed sober throughout my pregnancies, and through the CRAFT program, I have made connections and friendships that I feel are lifelong. I get parenting skills through the program, and we're actually working to prepare my daughter for preschool. We go through and make sure my daughters are up to their developmental milestones, and I get different ideas and tips from Jen, the child care coordinator, to figure out things I can work on to better meet their development. Through the home visits, we set goals, and we go through the goals that I've achieved, and we talk about things that I need to work on to help better my life. The different parenting tips are, we talk about healthy eating, potty training, and learning how to connect with my child and her and their emotions and controlling mine. And I get to connect with other moms going through the same developmental stages as well as maintaining sobriety. The staff has also been able to direct us to other resources to help improve our lives, such as different kid activities, therapy, adult activities, and other resources. We also do parent and child time at the end of the group, giving us a chance to work with Jen and do fun activities with the children, as well as different questions about my child's development and behavior. And it's just helped me all around feel like I'm becoming a better mother and maintaining sobriety. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hendrickson. Now, you said you began services in 2003. Your daughters must be...
I have a two-year-old and a... just turned 1 year old, so I'm going to be graduating the program actually this month.
2013.
Oh,
2013.
Oh my gosh. I said 2003. I'm sorry.
Oh, all right. Good enough. I was trying to put that in context. Well, thank you for your testimony. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to both testifiers. That was very good. But I think once in a while, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I think what's missing is what has been appropriated in the past on these on these programs, and it would just be interesting to know what has been appropriated and also the success rate of these programs in the past.
Some of the outcomes.
Yep.
Senator Franzen, is there a current ongoing appropriation to support this pilot project in Olmsted County, and what's the level of it, and what are the outcomes?
Mr. Chair, I do have with me Sarah Messel to address that issue.
Ms. Messelt, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Sarah Messelt. I'm the executive director at MOFAS, and previously the CRAFT Olmsted County program has been appropriated at $180,000 per year. And that's what this bill is looking to do, is to expand that program, replicate that program in 8 to 10 more communities across the state.
And was there matching funds to support this program, or was it in state-funded primarily?
It was state-funded.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I guess I understand, Senator Franzen, that there's one to Olmsted County and one to St. Louis County. The bill doesn't really talk about the eight different programs. It does, or 8 to 10 different programs, how they will be dispersed throughout the state. I'm not sure who's in charge of that, and what are the collaborative programs that are already in place, or are we recreating something that's already in place? Are we just giving more support? A lot of questions there.
Ms. Messel, and also maybe just in foundation for this, is that $180,000, does that end, or is that in the base? Does that continue? Because I noticed that you're mentioned in Olmsted and St. Louis, and I know St. Louis County has that Superior Babies. Is that this one too? Yeah. So do those pilot programs end? Is that why they need to be part of this appropriation? Is that?
Chairman, Senator Rosen, yes, the Olmsted County program will end. That's not part of the base. And the Superior Babies St. Louis County program has been funded by county dollars. And so this bill would fund those two programs with state funding, and then there would be a competitive request for proposal process that MOFAS would manage to identify 8 additional communities across the state. And that would be based on where the need is the greatest and then where the community collaboratives are strongest. And so they would be replicated, or they would be a competitive request for proposal process.
That's helpful. Any other questions of members? Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just looking at 8% of the appropriation for administrative costs. I think that's something to contemplate. But, Senator Franzen, I was wondering if you could help me understand where this fits. I hear the services that are being offered to the moms. We're also looking at expanding the visiting nurses programs. We have ECFE who does a lot of child engagement. So where does it fit with everything else that we try to do to support moms? Visiting nurses starts at 28 weeks. When does this start, and how would it be different?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Friend.
And Senator Benson, I'll address the 8%, and then I'll let Ms. Messel talk about how the program actually works, how they identify clients and so forth. And I'll give you my perspective. But the 8% administrative fee, you have mentioned that in the past, so I do want to address that. It goes towards the funding will cover program costs, including recruiting additional grantees, managing requests for proposal, coordinating the review committee, training the grantees on the curriculum, providing technical assistance for site and site visits, technical assistance in program, and budget management and evaluation. So it might seem a big figure, but it encompasses a lot of managing the program, not just processing grants. It's really emphasizing on giving the technical support and managing the program itself and the curriculum. So that's where the 8% goes towards. In terms of your second question, I do have a bill on school home visiting. So I think these are tools in the toolbox that the state can use to target those families that are most at risk. And in this particular case, families and mothers who have been exposed or are potentially have chemical dependency, we know it's 100% preventable. So it's the biggest bang for our buck, in my opinion, to really target more dollars in an area that we know we can 100% be able to have results. And we have proven results. And I'll let Ms. Messel talk about those results.
Chairman.
Ms. Messel.
Yes. I think the thing that is really important to differentiate with this program is that it's not replicating any of those amazing programs that you talked about, but it is really mobilizing community resources and connecting very at-risk moms with their social supports in their community. Many of us grew up having built-in social supports with aunts and grandmas and neighbors and friends that when we hit a rough patch that we might have opportunity. And most of our communities are willing to step up and be that with some of our very at-risk families. But oftentimes, moms are disenfranchised, they're disconnected, they're isolated, and they're struggling with their addiction. So what this program does is it doesn't replicate any of those programs, but it maximizes that by connecting with moms that come to the program through self-referral, through child protection, through law enforcement, through medical providers. And it really works with a woman, not just for 28 days in a traditional treatment pattern, but for a long-term commitment to help her solve and work with her to really weather those bumps. So, for example, if you are in treatment for 28 days, come back, and your car still doesn't start, and you still have overdue bills, those problems still exist. And so this really provides that long-term social support network for the mom to be able to be the success stories like our moms that are now, really working and being engaged in their communities. I think it's important to note that during one reporting period of in this recent reporting period that the Olmsted County project had 44 moms that had random tox screens, and all 44 of those moms had negative tox screens. So the program is working. It's high touch, low tech. It's really extending a strong, warm hand to a mom and helping her through to be committed to long-term sobriety.
Senator Bent.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Metz, so when do you encounter these moms? We're talking about fetal alcohol syndrome, but I haven't heard gestationally when you encounter the moms.
Ms. Mussel.
Chairman, Senator Benson, they come to the program at all different points during their pregnancy. Obviously, the goal is to identify them and work with them as early as possible in pregnancy. So our hope is that we will see them very, very, very early. But if that's not the case, we will include them and have them come into the program at any time. They're referred in many, many different ways, and so it really depends upon the referral source.
All right. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 948? Seeing none, Senator Franzen moves that Senate File 948 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Franzen. Okay. Senator Champion, we're going to give you a second shot to see if you can do a little bit better about not blowing up our committee time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Senate File 1078.
Yes, Senate File 1078. This bill will update the data practices statute in an age of greater care coordination for public clients. Success in addressing high health care costs, particularly for low-income persons, is care coordination. Coordination of various needs like physical health needs, housing needs, employment needs, mental health needs, etc. Counties are being asked to deliver better resources and achieve better outcomes for people on public health programs. They have to innovate. Helping them innovate will keep costs down and continue improvements in health outcomes. So Hennepin Health is a model for innovation, and you'll hear a little more about it, but it's for the lowest income clients, and they coordinate health care and social services. They have highly successful outcomes. Amongst the biggest challenges are people with multiple needs. So there are individuals who have both mental and physical health issues, housing, and employment. So difficult and highly inefficient to coordinate separate systems of care and supports when you are homeless, mentally ill, and with chronic diseases. So the problem is that there's a restriction on the data sharing limits providers' ability to coordinate these services. And so the data practices statute prohibits client data from the welfare side of the system. So without proper interventions, these clients get little preventative care and end up in the ER, which is the most expensive way by which to do things. So we are talking about the system's highest users. So half have chemical dependency, one-third are homeless, 40% are mentally ill, and almost one-third have multiple chronic diseases. So we have supports for each of these. So Hennepin County and others have supports for each of these, but the data practices statute prohibits one system from talking to the other system. So the solution we believe that this bill provides, it would permit social workers to access client data for coordinating care. Once care coordinators are able to track homeless persons, we can get them into care. Social workers will be able to secure housing support for those who are currently in inpatient chemical dependency programs with their permission, of course. And so we have some safeguards. Quickly, clients would sign a consent form at the initial contact. This allows data sharing only for the purposes of coordinating care, does not allow them to access data for other purposes. And clients have told us that they thought we already can do this coordination and are disappointed when they find out that state law prohibits this. So with that, Mr. Chair, and members, I will now pass it over to my testifier, Ross Owen, who is the director of Hennepin Health.
Welcome to the committee. Ross, I missed your last name.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Ross Owen, O-W-E-N.
Okay.
And I'm pleased to be here this morning to speak a little bit about the work going on in Hennepin County and Hennepin Health, and why we are in emphatic support of Senate File 1078 as one of the systems across Minnesota that would really be benefited from this law, supporting our integration efforts at lowering costs and improving outcomes for the population that we serve. Senator Champion did a great job of giving the overview of Hennepin Health's goals and the challenges across systems of care that our population serves, so I won't rehash those, but broadly speaking, our approach to reforming health care really rests on a growing body of evidence that most of what drives health outcomes and health care spending happens out in the community. It's social factors and behavioral factors, not what happens inside the walls of our clinics and hospitals, that's most likely to lead to the success or failure of our efforts. And to lower health care costs, then, we need to be able to use data and information to coordinate that care, not just the health care, but the other services that we know are so closely linked to health. And Hennepin Health, in its 3 years of existence, has really been the flagship effort in Hennepin County and the most concrete example of the importance of that integration. And through a number of the services which have traditionally not been part of healthcare programming that Senator Champion talked about, we've been able to achieve sustained reductions in hospitalizations as well as emergency department use among this population that, because of our unique total cost of care funding structure, we're able to retain in the system and reinvest in further improvements in our care models. It has been our experience in Hennepin Health that a health reform approach that ignores these social, environmental, and behavioral factors and focuses solely on health outcomes is a losing strategy. So despite our Hennepin Health model and its early successes, we do have gaps that really persist in our ability to share this information, particularly in the areas of data classified as welfare and mental health data under the law. And I have a couple of very brief patient stories that I hope will help illustrate this gap and what would be achieved by closing it. So the first example is of a real client named Rick, who is a homeless client who we've been successful in connecting to a primary care provider and a team of care coordinators in the clinic. And with the support of housing navigation and the supports that Hennepin Health offers, that care coordination team has located a supportive housing option for Rick with a relatively tight time window for placement. And because of a disconnected cell phone number, that team is unable to get in touch with Rick. And they know that he uses a number of different homeless shelters around the Minneapolis area. But because they're not able to contact him in real time, they're unable to bring the resource to him. Meanwhile, we have staff in the shelter who are very much aware of where Rick is staying at that night. But because of their inability to share the data, they can't make that connection. And perhaps that resource won't be brought to bear that would stabilize his condition and reduce healthcare costs and improve outcomes. And the second example of one is of a patient named Mary, who is admitted to Hennepin County Medical Center for a mental health condition. And unbeknownst to the hospital team that's working on her discharge plan, Hennepin County is at the same time working on commitment proceedings in the criminal justice system. And she is released into the community because of this lack of information sharing, where her condition deteriorates and she is readmitted to the hospital within 14 days. And our ability to share this mental health information more proactively could have prevented this outcome and sped up the process of getting this patient the level of service that she really needs. And so in summary, Senate File 1078 would close gaps like this and allow more seamless sharing of information that would achieve what we're all trying to achieve in reforming our healthcare delivery and payment systems. We thank you for your support of this bill and for the chance to speak with you on it this morning.
Mr. Owen, Senator Champion, as we look at the fiscal note, there's currently no cost associated with this proposal right now, but I'm actually a pretty strong proponent of the type of information sharing that I do believe really yields better healthcare outcomes and saves money for the systems and helps people do better. I'm wondering if you're amenable to adding a little bit of a report to try to check in after a year or so and see how things have fared and whether we can demonstrate that through this better use of the ability to coordinate the care provided to the entire individual, we could demonstrate the better care and the and some savings, maybe even. So is that something you'd be amenable to trying to work on? I don't think we have language ready right this minute to add a report to this, but we'd probably have to keep it in the Finance Committee, even though it doesn't have a cost right now, if we were to add that report. Is that something you'd be amenable to, Senator Champion?
Mr. Chair, yes, I am. I think that would be great.
Okay. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1078? Seeing none, Senator Rosen, move Senate File 1078. Be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Hey,
thank
Mr.
you, Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, thank you, but I do believe that you were trying to slow down my whole process here so that I'd have to stay here a moment longer. I don't know if I like that, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Committee.
Thank you, Senator Champion. Senator Claussen, Senate File 1246. Senator Claussen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Laurie and committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1246. It's a healthcare workforce initiative. This is the fifth stop of committee hearings for this bill. So I think some of you have actually heard this bill previously in policy or another committee. So what I'd like to do today is just spend some time talking about how this bill originated and then go through the fiscal implications per Senator Sharon's request. Before I do that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A7 amendment.
Senator Claussen, this isn't the committee first stop, so it wouldn't be an author's amendment, and you're not a member of the committee, so you can't offer it. But Senator Sharon offers the A7 amendment to have it before us. But then we better have a description of of what it is and how it fits in the bill. And you can incorporate it into the presentation as you wish.
I will do so, Mr. Chair. Three basic things that the amendment does. One, it expands the council membership and defines membership terms of the Minnesota Healthcare Workforce Council as part of the bill. It expands eligibility for clinical training grants and also identifies appropriations relating to the bill. I also have found that there
Senator
are
Senator Claussen, let me just interrupt for 1 second. Members had an A6 in their packets. We are not planning to move the A6. The A7 was handed out. I saw some people shuffling papers and want to make sure they can follow along. Sorry about that. Continue, Senator
Claussen. Well, thank you for the clarification, Mr. Chair. I did find there are two entry errors on the A7 amendment. First of all, in line 1.31 of the A7 amendment, on line 12, pharmacy should replace pharmacist, typing error. And then we also have an error on line 2.3 and 2.4 of the A7 amendment. $357,000 replaces $320,000 in the 2016 fiscal year, and $351,000 replaces $435,000 in fiscal year 2017.
Senator Claussen, those aren't the numbers that are on lines 2.3 and 2.4 of the A7 amendment. Are they?
No,
that's why he's making an oral amendment to it.
He's making an oral amendment.
But I mean, you're.
I'm replacing those, Mr. Chair.
But it was 435 in 16. You said 3 something in 16 is what's being replaced.
Yeah,
maybe repeat it. I was trying to track and wasn't able to. Maybe I'm.
$357,000 replaces $320,000 in 2016.
Well, 320 is...
So it's the wrong date.
For 2017 in the amendment here.
I've got my years mixed up.
Okay.
357 replaces...
435.
Let's see here. I apologize here. I thought we had this down. There's $435,000.
It's 435 in 2016 and 320 in 2017 on the A7 amendment that we have before us.
So $357,000 replaces 435 and 351,000 replaces in 2017 replaces 325.
352, I'm told.
I had the years reversed. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. So we're okay, good to go?
352 should be the number for 2017, I'm informed by fiscal staff.
Very good. Right.
I'll still pass the offer the A7 amendment with the oral amendments.
Okay. So we have it before us. Have you described the whole amendment then?
No, I'll continue in my...
Yeah.
Okay. Senate File 1246, a result of two legislative actions. In 2014, the legislature authorized a two-year health care commission to identify current and anticipated health care workforce shortages and evaluate the effectiveness of incentives to retain a highly skilled workforce. The commission met through the summer of 2014 and the fall as well to develop preliminary recommendations for this legislative body. The charge statement for the commission and membership can be found in the PowerPoint handout that you have on pages 2 and 3. And I would also like to acknowledge the work of Senators Benson and Lori, who served on the commission and are members of this committee. In 2013, the legislature initiated the study to assess mental health workforce needs. Over 30 mental health professionals met for 18 months, conducted 20 community forums and outreach meetings throughout the state, surveyed over 500 residents, and held a mental health summit attended by over 150 professionals. So Senate File 1246 reflects the work of these two legislative initiatives and is the second of two bills resulting from these actions, the first being Senate File 3, a health care loan forgiveness proposal. Senate File 3 addresses the end of the job pipeline, replacing people in rural and underserved communities by providing loan forgiveness initiatives, and recommendations highlighted from the two work groups can be found on pages 7 and 8 of that PowerPoint handout. Senate File 1246 is intended to fill the healthcare workforce pipeline through five major provisions, and these are found in the body of the bill. Section 1 establishes a Minnesota Healthcare Workforce Council. It identifies the purpose and responsibilities of the council, defines council membership, and requires the council prepare a comprehensive workforce plan every 5 years, and also includes provisions to report to the governor and to the legislature. That cost is $357,000 in 2017 and $351,000 in 2016. We just went through that. Section 2 establishes a grant program to expand clinical training facilities and sites for physician assistants, advanced practice registered nurses, and mental health professionals. Workforce Commission and the Mental Health Workforce Group both learned of the challenges in providing the training needed to advance practice nursing, physician assistants, mental health students, the hands-on skills that they need to begin practice. And these grants will begin to address that need for providing support for 10 to 15 programs each year. The annual allocation would be $3 million on that. Section 3 expands primary care physician residency grants in family medicine, psychiatric, geriatrics, general surgery. Over 3 years, these grants would fund 48 new primary care residency slots. That is a $5.7 million allocation annually. And Section 4 provides for grant incentive programs for preceptors who mentor a medical student or medical resident, advanced practice nursing, registered nurse, physician assistant or a medical health professional student. The Workforce Commission learned that many individual preceptors are not compensated for teaching and are finding it more and more challenging to make room in their schedules to serve as preceptors. And this section would provide up to $1,500 a year to preceptors who are not otherwise compensated for teaching and mentoring, and that is an allocation of $3 million annually. You have several handouts. You have a letter from the Minnesota National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. You have Minnesota maps identifying areas of health care shortage, workforce areas as well. And providing testimony, I'd like to introduce Mr. Mike Belzer, Chief Medical Officer and Medical Director, Hennepin County Medical Center.
Dr. Belzer, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Dr. Michael Belzer. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Hennepin County Medical Center, a position I've had for over 25 years. Additionally, I'm the Vice Chair of the Minnesota Legislature Mandated and Funded Medical Education Research Committee, the MERC committee that represents virtually all of the provider training and teaching sites in Minnesota. On behalf this morning of the Metro Minnesota Council for Graduate Medical Education, a council that represents 16 teaching hospitals, 1,400 residents and fellows, we believe that the recommendations and reforms in the bill will certainly advance healthcare workforce training and access to training opportunities. A point of interest, 70% of our residents that train in our program stay in Minnesota. Let me specifically address briefly three components of the bill. First, the primary care residency expansion. Funding for residency positions and slots for training sites were capped 20 years ago in 1996. Obviously, much has transpired in the last 20 years to alter that landscape. Without going into any detail, there's a widely agreed upon shortage of physicians and providers in Minnesota, and we certainly need more primary care residency training positions. Minnesota's teaching hospitals will support this grant program by committing to expand our existing residencies. Second, the Health Professions Preceptor Initiative. I think you're aware that in addition to being a public good, healthcare is a business. Providers are compensated on their production. Teaching students adversely affects clinicians' production, and the key limiting factor we've found from a ton of different sources is that the key limiting factor for finding preceptors, especially for advanced practice provider students, is their unwillingness to do this because it interferes with their productivity-based compensation. And just this last month, in discussion with our advanced provider practice home, we have run into several students who have month-long to year-long delays in their graduation from advanced practice provider schools because they can't find a teaching site willing to meet that particular rotation that they need. The grant program will definitely give teaching preceptors and programs an incentive to teach new faculty. And then finally, the bill allow for expansion and institution of new teaching sites, new clinical sites, especially outpatient clinics, that are much more appropriate for training primary care providers and hospital training sites. And the final question is, will these incentives work? In my opinion, definitely yes, and in the opinion of our Metro Minnesota board as well. We are constantly asked at our hospitals to expand residency training programs, but because of the cap slots from 20 years ago, every year we need to say no. We've queried many advanced practice provider at our institutions, and they tell us if we can provide some compensation for their decreased productivity, they would love to teach students. So we're very optimistic that this incentive would work. And so let me just say thank you for allowing me to testify in support of Senate File 1246. I'd like to express my thanks to the Workforce Council and for Senator Clausen, Benson, and Lori for the fine work you did to bring us to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Belzer. Questions of committee? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Clausen, you in your sheet here talks about evaluating the current MERC formula. I was just looking for that language in the bill. Could you direct me to that?
Senator Clausen.
I'm going to ask Mr. Rosenbaum from the department to come forward. And
Mr. Schoenbaum, where in the
Schoenbaum? Rosenbaum again. I did that before. Schoenbaum.
state your name for the record and help us.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department, wearing a couple of hats today. For this question, I'm wearing the hat as a staff member to the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission. Senator Rosen, what you see in the PowerPoint, and if you were to look in the full report, shows you that the commission came up with many recommendations. What's reflected in the bill from working with the co-chairs of the committee are the first set of recommendations. The commission will be reconvening during the interim to kind of take the next bite perhaps reporting back to you with additional recommendations in the future.
Thank you.
So the recommendation on the slide is not in Senate File 1246, the recommendation to review the current Merck distribution formula, correct?
Correct.
Yes. Okay. Any other questions of members?
Just a comment.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Claussen, I do know that I have to get dental in at least once a day, but this is probably one of the biggest bills as far as helping us work on workforce shortage, specifically our dental shortage out in the rural areas in Minnesota. This is huge. So I appreciate your work on this, your fine work, and the task force work on it also.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1246? Actually, before we move, we better move that amendment. We didn't adopt that. Senator Sharon moved the A7 amendment as orally amended. Any questions on that motion? Seeing none on Senator Sharon's motion on the A7, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. So now the bill in shape and before us. Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1246 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Senator Pappas, very timely. Senate File 1119. And Senator Pappas, now we have a quite lengthy bill in front of us, but we have a delete everything amendment that my understanding is removes
Mr. Chairman,
all of the
right,
fiscal
the A5
implications.
Amendment.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, just for a little background, the traditional midwives have been had their licensing and their oversight in the Board of Medical Practice, and we did explore moving them to the Department of Health as just a better fit for the organization, and the fiscal note came in really too high and not affordable for the midwives because we're talking about how many midwives? 29 midwives, and we have, I don't know, the fiscal note is varied. I think the latest fiscal note might be in some $30,000. So what we have then is the A5 amendment, which is really just to make a minor change to the membership of the Advisory Council on Licensed Traditional Midwife. We think that they've been having a hard time finding a licensed physician who has collaborated with traditional midwives and kind of understands the practice and has worked with them. And we think that by providing a recommendations from the Minnesota Council of Certified Professional Midwives that we might be able to find a doctor who is willing to serve and can provide that that connection between the midwives and the Board of Medical Practice.
And Senator Pappas, this policy provision was in the original bill that's the member a part of the delete everything and was heard in the policy division, right?
Yes.
So you're delete, you have a delete all that just keeps that one policy provision that did pass.
That's right.
the policy.
That's right, Mr. Chairman, it was.
So we'll ask if somebody from the department can come forward and confirm that, that if we adopt this A5 amendment, there is no cost left with the bill. Somebody. Mr. Greenman is coming up. Mr. Greenman?
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Health. There is no cost to the department for this bill.
Okay. Once the A5 is adopted. Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, we would really really appreciate you considering this for inclusion. We would appreciate if you would consider this for inclusion in your omnibus bill.
Once we've removed the cost, my understanding was we were going to send this. Okay. So your preference is to leave it, to lay it over for possible inclusion, okay?
Or include it.
Today we're just laying over for possible inclusion.
I just really felt that the room needed to laugh.
Okay. Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, where's the companion in the House?
Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, good question. We had a companion in the House. I believe it was Representative Loon. Somebody, Susan? Representative Lohmer. And they were waiting for a fiscal note. And I think because of their budget issues and because this did have a fiscal cost, they did not want to move forward with it. And so we didn't really get a hearing in the House. And so this is just really a minor change. That's why we need to put it in the omnibus bill. We don't have a bill running separately in the House.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A5.
Senator Rosen moves the A5 amendment. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Okay.
That was just the A5 amendment. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas. What is on line of the amendment, page 2, line 2, we are using again a specific treatment, designating a specific treatment. Just wondering what that is. And
go ahead and try to say it, Senator Rosen.
Excuse me?
Go ahead and try to say
well,
it.
Well, I was trying to say it myself.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator
Rosen, Ms. Hogan's going to address that.
Hi, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kate Hogan. I'm a licensed midwife, a certified professional midwife, and I also sit as one of the traditional midwives on the advisory council to the Board of Medicine. The reason that we're adding this line about maternal RhoGAM treatment is because it's a very routine standard of prenatal care for women who have Rh-negative blood type. And it's already addressed in the first page here under practice standards. It's already listed as it's a routine part of our care. And so just adding it to that second page saying that we can administer it, it just clarifies that it is a scope of our practice. And so it makes it easier for us to order it. So it's just sort of an accessibility issue.
Okay. And again, this was part of the policy that went through the policy division, correct?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1119? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves Senate File 1119 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Now
you can go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank
members.
You. Senator Herr, Senate File 1691.
Mr. Chair, we don't have any more, do we?
I do in my packet.
I do. Maybe I. It's just something
wrong. we went out of order, so that might have thrown you off.
That might have thrown me off, yeah.
Do other members have?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
besides the...
Senator Hurst, Senate File 1691. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing Senate File 1691.
Okay, thank you.
This bill asks for mental health attention to the Southeast Asian veterans who fought alongside our U.S. troops during the Vietnam War. Majority of the Southeast Asian veterans who are now Minnesotans do not have the same status as the U.S.-born, as their U.S.-born counterpart, and therefore do not qualify for the same veteran benefit that provide counseling for veterans. There's no longstanding system in place in our state to diagnose mental instability of the Southeast Asian veteran, nor encourage them to seek treatment. These veterans put their lives on the line to protect American freedom, and now their children and grandchildren are contributing citizens and taxpayer of our state. This bill, Senate File 1691, set aside an amount as competitive grant to nonprofit to work specifically with Southeast Asian veterans in Minnesota by designing programs that would guide them toward mental health evaluation in a culturally appropriate way. This small investment can save our state resources in the long run, as it prevents possible future mishap. And another positive note is that it gives deserving attention to our forgotten heroes. My witness here can tell you more about the subject, and thank you for the time, and I will answer any question after my presenters. With me is Mr. Ba Zhou Vu on my right here, and Mr. Thomas Nguyen on my left.
Thank you, Senator Hurt. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to all the senators. My name is Ba Zhou Vu. I'm a vice president of Lao Hmong Veterans Organization in Minnesota. I am a veteran. I have served the veterans for, since 1995 to the present time. I see a lot of veterans have a lot of stress, have stressful due to the war, during the Vietnam War. And I really appreciate if you we can have funding for our veterans organization. That would be great, because we have four organizations that we have not received any funding from any government or state or federal. So we need money or funding available to help our own veterans to save their life, to prevent the mental and also to prevent the killing each other. Like in the past, a few years ago, you see, you can hear that the father killing his own son. So we want to prevent, if we can have a funding for our four organizations to working closely with our own veterans and also with their families. If we do not have anyone helping them solve the problem dealing with this issue, then we don't want to, it's going to be a more and more problem, more issue. So we want to the government to give the funding available for us to help our own veterans. Because 100,000 does not mean a lot to your people, but it means a lot to my people, to my veterans, to the families. So my concern is if we still continue not to have funding for our veterans or serve for my veterans, and we're going to have face more problems. So thank you so much for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Vu, for your testimony. And you have one more, Mr. Nguyen, is that correct?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Dr. Thomas Nguyen. I'm a licensed psychologist and a clinical supervisor at the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation Southeast Asian Services. I am among the few Vietnamese doctoral-level psychologists in the state of Minnesota. I was born in Vietnam. My father proudly served in the South Vietnamese Army, and he fought alongside with the American allies. He, too, was a political prisoner and have experienced significant trauma. I have been inundated with countless horrific stories following the fall of Saigon and its domino effects on its neighboring countries. In my profession, I have the honor of serving the Southeast Asian refugees and immigrants who have experienced significant war trauma and ensuing forced migration experience. Many are not eligible for health coverages and services available to their American peers, the brave men and women who serve this great country. Therefore, I'm here today to express my support for the Senate File 1691, to advocate for the cultural specific mental health services to Southeast Asian veterans, for the men and women who have valiantly served during the secret war in Laos or the war in Vietnam, who have suffered silently due to mental health stigma, limited community resources, and cultural and language barriers that may have prevented them from seeking services. Veterans from Southeast Asian communities continue to experience significant stressors that negatively influence both their physical and emotional health. Trauma-related stressors can carry long-term psychological impact long after resettlement in the United States. In a study of Vietnamese veterans, over 90% of those surveyed exhibit PTSD symptoms. In my research and practice, veterans I serve continue to exhibit symptoms of depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, or known as PTSD, and cultural bounce syndromes as correlated with victims of war and migrations. Recently, I agreed to see a Vietnamese veteran for pro bono services. He did not have health insurance at the time. He reported symptoms of depression and anxiety due to recurrent intruding thoughts about the war. He said that he's embarrassed and was unable to share his story to anyone due to shame. He came back the following session and shared that he was able to eat and sleep better following the initial session. He said that he feels comforted because his therapist does not think that he's crazy. As a clinician, I find that Southeast Asian veterans lack the knowledge of and are unaware of available mental health services, lack of the familiarity with the Western-based mental health treatment, and has limited English proficiency, which prevented them from accessing services. The passage of this bill is extremely important to our Southeast Asian communities in ensuring that the brave men who serve are getting appropriate services they deserve and are getting referral for cultural-specific mental health services. Thank you for your time. I look forward to answering any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Nguyen and Senator Herr. So this looks like a competitive grant program. Senator Herr, do you have an idea who potential grantees that would have the capacity to do this would be? I mean, I think, Mr. Nguyen, you said you were from the Wilder Foundation.
Yes.
Is that correct? Would you guys be anticipating being one of the applicants for this, or is there others that you're?
Mr. Chair, I would say
Senator
possibly Wilder Foundation would be one. You know, Hmong American Partnership could be another. There could be a handful of them out there that can compete for this, depending on how they appeal to DHS guideline.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions of members? Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, we're going to have quite a bit of mental health talk as we go through in the omnibus bill, so I'll be interested to see where this fits with other culturally specific mental health work. I think the veterans issue is unique. I guess I hadn't realized that there was the gap, because in other ways they're recognized as veterans, and so I would be interested to see where this fits with everything else. Thank you, Senator Herr.
Thank you, Senator Benson.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1691? Seeing none, Senator Rosen, co-author, moves Senate. Or wait, you're on the committee. Senator Herr moves Senate File 1691.
My co-author, Senator Rosen. I was going to thank her for being one of my co-author, and I give her the.
Okay. Well, then Senator Rosen does move Senate File 1691 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus bill. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Herr.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
In the committee.
I think we can get Senate File 1878 in. Senator Rosen. Well, this one's pretty straightforward. Fill in a couple of dot, dot, dots. And
yeah, that's right. Moving along, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1878 is our Community Action Grant Bill. And I do, if I can so move, filling in the dots would be currently, I should say, right now they receive $4 million per year. We are increasing it up to $8 million per year, which would bring it to the 2003-2004 level of appropriation. So we all love our CAP agencies. And it's kind of, I always like to say it's kind of like a politician. You want to get rid of all of them except your own politician because he's pretty good. he or she is pretty good. get rid of the rest of them. But I am a very big fan of my CAP agency, as we all are. And I just wanted to say that they have a couple. You're all familiar with what the CAP agencies do, but mine in specific. Which is Minnesota Valley Action Council, and Senator Sharon's, actually, has a program that deals with the Strong Fathers program, and it's unique. It's very successful. They have some wonderful outcomes, engaging dads and father figures ongoing. So it's a pilot program, and it's had wonderful results. They also have at MVAC the Food Hub, which is a wonderful experience in their selling and selling to school programs to free and reduced children. They have the home ownership program. They also, of course, do FAME, which we're very familiar about, help assistance for buying homes and businesses. And, of course, which I think is amazing, is our LIHEAP program. And just speaking for AMVAC alone in Mankato, they served 7,700 households this year. And despite the fairly mild winter, their energy bills were still $45 higher per month than last year. So they're replacing a lot of furnaces. There's a lot of homes that need repair, that the housing stock is old and needs a lot of repair. With that, Mr. Chair, I do have Arnie Anderson, who is the director of Minnesota Community Action Partnership, and I also have Lori. I have Ms. Schultz, Lori Schultz, who is the TRICAP director for St. Cloud, Senator Fischbach, and Senator Brown's district. And also Mr. Patrick McFarland from Anoka, who is the vice chair of MNCAP, is also here in the room, but I don't think he's going to be testifying. So we will keep it short. I do appreciate this hearing, though.
All right. Very much. Let's go ahead and move your amendment. Senator Rosen moves to replace the blank appropriations, both blank appropriations on line 1.5 with $4 million. Any questions on that? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. All right. Mr. Anderson, you wish to start the testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Arnie Anderson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. We're the statewide association, voluntary membership association for Minnesota's community action agencies. A year ago, community action agencies were being hailed as heroes for their performance during the propane crisis. This year, they're under a cloud. The fact is, community action agencies are neither saints nor sinners. They're just regular folks doing their best year in and year out to serve Minnesota families who are struggling to get by. Most of the people served by CAP agencies are already working or seniors. They are people who have trouble getting by or who have experienced a crisis. CAPs help to stabilize their lives. That's good for them. That's good for their employers. That's good for their communities, especially the schools. In recognition of your packed agenda today, we'll be very brief. I'm going to make five quick overview points. Then Lori Schultz, one of our bright new CAP directors, will take a minute to describe one of the common sense things that they do at TRICAP in St. Cloud.
Ms. Schultz, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning. Lori Schultz, Executive Director of TRICAP.
And provide your testimony. Continuing. Okay.
I'm sorry for any confusion. So first, there's nothing simple about community action. We would welcome the opportunity to spend 4 hours in front of your committee going through this annual report cover to cover.
You're not welcome to do that.
We'll read it.
We hope you understand that it's very difficult to communicate the importance of this Community Action Grant in 10 minutes. Second, the Community Action Grant funds are local programming and local control, and they're the yellow tab in this handout that shows you the statewide map and some of the basics of community action. This approach is unique in all of state government. In 1964, the Economic Opportunity Act called for the poor to have maximum feasible participation in identifying local problems and identifying local solutions to poverty. In 1967, Congress adopted then Congressman Al Quie's amendment that institutionalized maximum feasible participation in today's federal mandate that community action agency boards must be composed of one-third local elected officials, at least one-third low-income, and one-third private sector. My third point is the red tab. There's a colorful grid in there showing community action state agencies funders, and in that there are three messages I'd hope to communicate. At the bottom of the page is a color key indicating all of the state agencies that provide funding to community action agencies. And it also shows that each agency has an exceptional and unique array of programming in their community. Next, when these programs are experienced through the eyes of a low-income family, it's a reality that each one of these federal and state programs comes to the local level with varying degrees of irrationalities that for that particular family's situation. The flexible funding of the Community Action Grant helps the CAP to better rationalize each one of these resources to each family's personal circumstances, one family at a time. Last, most of these programs on this matrix are based on a centralized bureaucratic command and control model. The Community Action Grant is exceptionally valuable because it is a complementary model driven by local needs, local solutions, and local control. My fourth point is on the green tab. You'll see in there the funding chart for the proposed, for Senator Rosen's bill to restore the funding to 2003 levels. That's a nominal dollar amount. It's not, does not account for inflation. On the back side of that page, it contains an estimate of how the funding formula would work for our member agencies if funded at the 2003 levels. The green sheet on that tab shows how remarkably successful community action agencies are at leveraging resources for their communities in greater Minnesota. It's quite a remarkable number. Lastly, accountability. We hope that members of the Senate are able to take the long view. Over the last 20 years, Minnesota's community action agencies have a tremendous track record for stewardship of public funds that we're proud to match against any peer. Additionally, every day community action agencies have to prove they deserve the trust of their low-income families in their local communities. There, too, CAP agencies have an exceptional long-term record. As public officials, as Senator Rosen noted, you probably have a pretty good idea how well your local agency is doing. So with that, that concludes my remarks, and we'll go to our outstanding new CAP director, Lori Schultz from St. Cloud.
Ms. Schultz, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning. I'm Lori Schultz, and I have the privilege of serving as the executive director for TRICAP, the community action agency that serves Stearns, Benton, and Sherburne counties in central Minnesota. Because TRICAP is an agency that serves both rural and urban communities, transportation can be an area of need that's different for different parts of the community. Through the use of community action funds, TRICAP has been able to provide innovative options for transportation referral services to meet the needs of citizens, ranging from preschool-age children to school-age children to people needing to get to their jobs, as well as senior citizens. Through this type of approach, we're also able to work with businesses such as workforce development agencies, large healthcare facilities, and schools, to be able to bridge the gap of the transportation needs that exist in our communities, whether that be to promote public transit, volunteer driver services, or other types of transportation needs, all with the mindset of getting our citizens where they need to go to be productive members in the community. We would not be able to provide these referral services and develop partnerships and new innovative programming without the use of community action funds. It's been very successful in our area as well as other areas in the state of Minnesota. And that's just one example of how we at TRICAP are meeting a local need through the local use of community action funds. So thank you.
Ms. Schultz, thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I believe the oral amendment was stated wrong.
Okay.
And I think we need to change that oral amendment. I believe we amended the bill for $4 million per year. That is current. Well, I'd like to amend it to $8 million per year, which would bring us up to the 2003 level.
Is that by adding the $4 million, it brings you to the $8
Brings
because
it up.
Because the $4 is in the forecast.
In the base.
And so this is adding to what's in the forecast.
Okay. Thank you
so
very much.
So if you want to do $8 then, you know, then
well,
we're bringing it to $12 You know,
right.
I don't
We could. But, Mr. Chair, and in the essence of time, too, I just would like to say this is, I received the CAP award last year along with Senator Pappas and several other representatives, I can't remember. And it's one of, I'm very proud to hang that award on my wall. And I feel this is a boots on the ground type of organization. As you can see on page 13, all the different areas that they work in, but they do, as Ms. Schultz said, they work specifically for the area that they serve, just the same as Senator Sharon and my MBAC, and they do a really wonderful job. So,
I think each and every one of us is very familiar with our CAP agency and incredibly supportive of the work they do, and have them on our frequent call, you know, dials. We refer constituents all the time for help, and the CAP agencies are very adept at finding what they can to put together resources to help people live more productive lives in our communities.
Absolutely. And Mr. Chair, if I could, one more thing. I know that's just me on the bill, and that was just because me it was my problem. I did not we were late, and I apologize. There could have been more authors, but it was just
we didn't think it was because nobody else likes caps.
I asked, you know.
Any other questions, Senator Benson?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, if we could talk about, we're basically doubling, so what's next? I think they've been doing a good job with what they have, so I need to know what's next.
What are the outcomes, reports?
Yes,
what do we expect from this?
What gaps are we filling? What has been waiting to happen that hasn't been executed? They work on really tight budgets. I respect the amount they accomplish. I would hate to see them get sloppy. I don't think that's in their culture, but I'd just like to know what's next.
Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, because there's local control of these funds, it's very hard for me to sit here today and say how each local agency would use the funds, and in fact it would need to go through their boards, and it would also need to be negotiated with the Department of Human Services, who oversees the work plans and budgets. In the report, there is a section on outcomes. We also have a relatively new report on 10 years of outcomes. And we also have a funny or maybe a not-so-funny saying that the effectiveness of a local CAP agency is inversely proportional to the ability to aggregate the results. So we live in a time when everybody wants statewide numbers. Our effectiveness is best measured individually, locally, by your local CAP agency. And we would be happy to meet with you, Senator Benson, or anyone at whatever length you would like to discuss this.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
It probably could be answered more of what programs have had to be scaled back, since we're just going back to the 2003 funding levels. I asked Ms. Schultz if there would be more LIHEAP that would be able to be dispersed. Of course, there would be if, depending on the winter, but I'm sure since 2003, we could go through the individual CAP agencies and say what programs had to be eliminated just because of funding.
I think, isn't the LIHEAP primarily funded through Commerce? So this is the HHS?
It goes through
portion?
The CAP.
Right, it goes through the CAP, but I mean, if we're going to pick up Commerce's responsibility, you know, we're starting to get a little nervous. We have pretty tight budgets over here in HHS.
And
administration
it costs.
Is through Fund of July.
I'm going to take that back, Mr. Chair.
No, that's all right. But I'm just, you know, I mean, I think that Senator Benson's question was a good one. I mean, $8 million for the biennium is a significant investment. And, you know, it's a pretty good question. So let's say we make this investment. What do we get for it?
Mr. Chair and members, if I could try a follow-up answer, I'm sorry, I was trying to be as brief as possible. If you look at the green chart that shows how CAP agencies get so much funding out to greater Minnesota, that is a result of sort of a virtuous circle. This community action grant money helps them to create creative, new, locally collaborative programs that are grant-worthy, either from state funders or from foundations, though there's a dearth of foundations in greater Minnesota. It also helps them to have the grant writing and planning capacity to be able to go out and get those funds. It's very common for CAP agencies to create some clever new thing, spin it off to somebody else, and then go on to invent the next new thing. The thing that has been of greatest difficulty for community action agencies over the last 10 or 15 years is that capacity for creativity has just been squeezed and squeezed and squeezed, and agencies are having all they can do to simply maintain daily activities. And so this becomes an extremely important investment in a creative, adaptive future.
Senator Benson?
I just think, Mr. Chair, the argument that just because it hasn't kept up with inflation isn't necessarily solid justification for $8 million a year. I will dig more into this. Maybe it would be more comfortable if we did a two and then two. It's being built into the base, and so doubling funding in 1 year if there's not institutional capacity to absorb it is going to end up in some slop. And so I just would like to think about how these dollars move forward. I believe in the work they do. I think they do it well, and I'm not saying no. I'm just saying it's a big leap in funding. I want to make sure that institutionally it's going to continue the discipline that has been the discipline in the past.
Senator Rosen?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, do you propose an amendment that you'd like to work on with this?
If it shows up in an omnibus bill, I'll see what it looks like then, and we can talk about it, and I can visit with the CAP folks and see where the money is going to go. Again, their work is good. I'm not going to propose an amendment right now because I don't want anybody to get scared about where it's going to go. But I think as we go forward, we're going to have to make some decisions. Not everybody. We've said yes to a lot of people today. So
we've said possible inclusion.
Which, Mr. Chair, in the hallway feels like a yes. So
any further questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1878? Seeing none, Senator Rosen moves Senate File 1878 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, members.
And we will recess and readjourn in this room. at 6 p.m. tonight. We did have Senate File 253 taken off of the list. That one is going to be re-referred to the floor. There, we did get the fiscal note, and there is no fiscal impact, so that will just be re-referred, and we don't have to hear it. With that, we stand in recess. Thank you for your time and attention, members.
Hey, Senator. I drafted a report on that 1078.